the aspects of our ignorance. The ignorance manifests as ego. I and the world, that separation, that line of separateness comes there, I and the world. That is product of ignorance. And then you have the desires, the ego, and then running after the world and the problems associated with that all come as product of ignorance. So, as the sign of removal of ignorance, these vices, let us adjust to separate them as against virtue, as I am calling them vices. Those vices are the signs of ignorance, and the virtues therefore are removal of that, and thus removal of ignorance. And as the ignorance is gone, the true knowledge of the self flashes, and that is becoming. Becoming that, you become the pure knowledge, or you become divine that you already are. Swami Vivekananda therefore defines religion as a manifestation of divinity already in us. That divinity is already in us, but it is obstructed due to various tendencies, various modifications of mind, which get congealed in life as many vices, bad habits. Now, those are to be renounced, those are to be given up, and then the personality changes. As it changes, automatically we see the signs of that knowledge start appearing in life. The drag for the so-called objects of enjoyment, that starts going away from life. The joy starts becoming more and more pronounced and more spontaneous. The joy that we get and which is dependent on getting some objects, that is really the source of suffering. One tries to get those objects thinking that they will give us joy. One gets the object and a pleasant sensation associated with it for a little while, but then that pleasant sensation too goes away, and we get the suffering and bondage too, because a tendency has been created to seek that object, and that tendency will make us again and again go into that action, go into seeking that object. So we get this bondage as a result of this. But this process of changing one's personality in the light of what scriptures call as virtue, that is a different thing. It transforms the life in such a manner that now the knowledge within gets the scope to manifest. And as a sign of that, the joy now is spontaneous. You don't have to depend on any object outside, like money. I am happy if I have money. If I don't have money, I am unhappy. Well, a sane person would be examining if money is the source of happiness. All those the wealthy people would be automatically happy. Look at the lives of them, how many of them are really happy. And we will see immediately that therefore money is not source of happiness. And that is true with any object, friends, that we think that that is going to bring happiness. But look at the lives of the people who have that object, and you will see that the miseries in life, the sufferings, they are not gone. They are still there. Some are, you know, unhappy because of them having money. Some are unhappy because they don't have money. Some are happy because they are married. Some are unhappy because they are married. So it is all like that, you know. It is the objects, they give you an illusion of happiness, but it is an illusion. And so it is very important that we get rid of this illusory idea that things in the world will give me happiness. So one when transforms the life in this direction, the joy becomes spontaneous. Love becomes spontaneous. It doesn't depend on any expectation now. The love in the world that we see is more or less bargaining. That I love you if you do this for me. If you don't, then I don't love you. The love in the world takes this shape. It is usually like a business, a mutual contract. That yes, we will love each other, you give me this, I give you this, and it works as long as that they both get the required benefits. But as soon as they are not there, the love disintegrates. So that is really not worth calling love. It is business. So the real love starts spontaneously manifesting in our lives once the spiritual awareness, I am the all-pervading self, starts dawning. When it starts manifesting, the love then does not depend on what I get or what I don't get. It is a very different thing that look at the love that the saints had. It does not ask for anything. It was not like a bargain. It is a pure, spontaneous expression of oneness. That I see one, the same self in everyone, and therefore that love was coming. So these signs of the knowledge will manifest in life. And now in the 12th verse, Lord says that how when you transform your life, what will you know? By that knowledge, what is going to be known? Let me tell you that what is going to be known. Lord says, Neyam yattas pravakshami yajnyatva amritam ashnate anadimat param brahma nasattannasadurchate. I shall tell you that which has to be known, knowing which one attains immortality. It is the beginningless supreme Brahman, which is said to be neither being nor non-being. A beautiful idea is presented here, that this, by that the knowledge, what do you know? Lord says, I am going to tell you what you know by that knowledge. And what is the result of acquiring that knowledge? Amritam ashnate. Amritam ashnate means you attain to immortality. Amritam is against mortality. So you attain to immortality by this knowledge. We have this desire to become immortal. We don't verbally express it always, but it is there in the subconscious all the time. Nobody really wants to die. As the old age or the disability they approach, we look for various cures so that this life will continue in this body. But that is no source of immortality. Someday, sooner or later, in spite of all medicines, one does kick the bucket. There is no, and it is good, you say, that there is nothing bad about it. That is, imagine how if people only get born and never die, what would have been the situation in the world? It wouldn't be a livable world. It is because the things get removed, that there is the meaning for this new creation. There is scope for new creation only if the other things they get removed at proper time. It is so. Immortality also we crave for. The real immortality can never be physical. The real immortality one gets through this identification with everything that changes and therefore is basically mortal. We identify ourselves with that which by very nature of those things, by very definition of those things, are mortal. So when I identify myself with all that which is mortal, I too become mortal automatically. When this knot is cut asunder by knowledge, when I know I am not anything that is changing, then there is nothing that can kill me. In fact, the new word death has no meaning there. The immortality is then reclaimed through this knowledge. We are immortal by this knowledge. We reclaim that immortality. And how is that thing that is known? Anadimat Param Brahma. That it is beginningless, supreme Brahman. It is one characteristic that is told about this is beginningless. And again it is a negative something, means beginning is what we understand. And so in contrast we have to say that which has no beginning. Everything in the world you will see that it has a beginning. Even this whole universe has a beginning, a big bang took place and then that after the big bang or so forth, whatever you call it, this world started coming. And so it has an end as well. It is everything that begins goes on changing and ends at one point. So everything in the world has a beginning. And so naturally we ask the question that when was it started? When is the person born? When you have to fill all the numerous forms, and if you are filling them online, you have to put fill the column and say date of birth. And then it has an asterisk mark, means it is a compulsory thing to be filled. If Brahman has to fill that form, it can't, you know, because it doesn't have a date of birth, no beginning. For everything else, there is a beginning, before which it wasn't there. So, that this thing, Brahman, this knowledge, is of that thing which has no beginning. And so that is permanent subject. everything. It is beyond time. No beginning means whatever is in time, you have the beginning. That which is beyond time, there is no sense to this word beginning at all. So, not that we do not know the beginning of it. Like a person, we do not know the date of that, the birth of that person. Many people themselves do not know the date of birth. It is surmised that maybe this child was born, especially in places where there are no such municipal facilities. A child is born, nobody kept the record on that day and what day it was. Everybody was busy doing something else, and so after a lot of time is gone and the child is sent to the school. Now that school now requires, say, what day the fellow was born, and so they think, oh, it was a very rainy day, and what was it the full moon day? May not be, but close to that, because we saw the moonlight a few days before, and so you surmise and think that this must be the date. You do not know the date, but that doesn't mean that the fellow has no birth. There is a beginning, there is a birth, only you do not know. Brahman is, what is described here is not like that, that it has a birth, but we forgot the date of birth of that Brahman. Not in that sense. There is no possibility of birth there. It is always there. It is beyond time. It is beyond the conception of time. So, the concept of past, present, future, they do not touch it. That is the important idea here. So, that is why it is not the subject of our secular knowledge. Our secular knowledge is about the objects which has birth, which has the beginning in time. They are all objects in time and space, and thus this object that is being told to be known is none of those. Moreover, another important aspect is told about it, and this is very intriguing. Nasat-tat-na-asal-chate, which is said to be neither being nor non-being. Yes, friends, it is not being in the sense of a particular object that we see. It is not existence in that sense, like this microphone exists, or the chair exists, or we all exist. That is a passing show. It is a continuous change. And so, that existence is truly speaking not existence. So, this Brahman, this all-pervading reality, this unborn thing, is not an existence of that type. It does not exist in the sense all these objects we say exist. It is not one of them. So, in that sense, you cannot say that it is. It is not the object of the knowledge of isness. Like you say, the chair is, this person is, that person is, our city of providence is. In that sense, that divine presence is not confined by this isness. Also, then would you say immediately the mind jumps to the opposite? So you should say then it doesn't exist. No, friends, it is said here that it is not non-existence also. Shankara, in his commentary on this, has said that it is not the object of the knowledge of non-existing. That you can say the horns of a rabbit, they don't exist. Do they exist? Horns of a rabbit? Did you see anybody saw the horns of rabbit? The ears look like horns, but the rabbit doesn't have horns. So just as the horns of rabbit, they do not exist, in that sense this Brahman, does it not exist like the horns on the head of rabbit? No, not in that sense. It is not non-existence in that sense. It is beyond both. That is why Buddha maintained what is called noble silence on these issues. You cannot say that it is or it is not. When he was asked, do you say God exists? He kept quiet. Because to say God exists means God would become an object like this that exists. We will compare like that. And if he says God does not exist, that also would create a wrong impression. So God is just a funny idea, like the horns on the head of a rabbit. Horns of rabbit, they don't exist. So God is like that. No. So it cannot be categorized either as is or is not, beyond both. This idea sounds a little complicated to grasp. Friends, yes, it is a little bit complicated because our understanding is conditioned by those things which are either are or are not. But this therefore becomes difficult to grasp unless we step out of this conditioning that things are either they are or are not. This kind of putting into boxes, pigeonholing the idea that something is or is not, this logic works in many of our normal dealings. It doesn't always work even there, but that is how we function in the world with what is called two-valued logic. Two-valued logic means every statement is assigned a value, T or F, true or false. Every meaningful statement is either true or false. So, if we think it is true, then we put it in the pigeonhole label T. And then, if it is false, we put it in the other pigeonhole F. And that is how we categorize all the statements here in this about this world. But this pigeonholing does not work when we have to describe that which is reality of all. This pigeonholing works for waves, not for the ocean. So, this important difference is actually pointed out by God here, that don't try to pigeonhole it. As Sri Ramakrishna used to say, that never say that God is this, this, this and this much. And never put a period after saying that, well, God is this, period. No. You can never do that about God. You cannot catch it or confine it within any adjectives that God is this, this, this. No. It is impossible to confine God. So, this is one understanding of this statement as given by the great commentators, is that it refutes any attempt to confine God. You can never confine God. So, But does it then mean that it doesn't exist? One question has been raised in Shankara's commentary that, well, Lord said that I am going to tell you about what is to be known, and after saying I will tell you what is to be known, what does he tell? It is neither existence nor non-existence. It didn't give anything really tangible information about it. Sounds just a hollow promise. Lord promised that I will tell that object of knowledge, knowing which you become immortal. So we perk our ears. Hey, what is it? Let me hear that, knowing which I will become immortal. And after giving this promise, what Lord says is, it cannot be said to exist, nor can it said to be non-existent. It doesn't say anything, it is just fooling us. But Shankara says there that no, it is not fooling you, it is telling you this, that it is not to be categorized as an object in the world. You have to step beyond. You cannot be confined in your awareness of subject and object. You cannot be confined into the that state where I am the enjoyer, the world is to be enjoyed. If we remain confined in this, then this knowledge is impossible for us. And therefore, Lord says that it is, remember, you have to step out. And now, he gives, these verses are really so beautiful, tremendously poetic and highly inspiring. That where do we then see God? How do we find His truth? Where do we look for it? Sarvata Panipadam Tat Sarvato Shishiro Mukham Sarvata Shruti Malloke Sarvamavritya Tishthate. With hands and feet everywhere, with eyes, heads and faces everywhere, with ears everywhere, it rests pervading everything in the world. Whatever I think, as say the head of Richard, it is not really head of Richard, it is the God that is to that all-pervading reality that is working through that head. So here is God, here is God, here is God. Everything that we can think of, that being works through all hands, sees through all eyes. These eyes are being used by that divine. It is the eyes of the divine. And this is, these are the lungs by which that divine is breathing. Let me feel the divine presence in each and everything. It is like feeling the ocean in every wave. Every wave that is rising and falling, but it is in reality ocean alone. Do you get this, George? Are you able to hear?
Yeah.
Good. Good. So, it is important therefore to get this message that Lord is in and through each and everything, that by mistake, because of ignorance, I call some of it as mine and something not mine. And this is my head and that is Richard's head. No, both are the heads of God. God is expressing through all these differentiations. And there is somewhere you see pleasure, somewhere pain. Lord is expressing through both these waves. There are those things that belong to a particular person. It is all pervaded by God. Sarvam avritti tishtati. That it is it rests pervading everything in the world. It rests pervading everything in the world. That rest is also an important word. That you see the dynamism in the world. Then this truth become mobile? Does it move about? It does not move, and yet it moves. So it rests without moving anywhere. It is pervaded in all the moving objects. It is you can take the instance, if you are seeing a movie and a car is running fast, you see in the movie, does the screen move? The car is running fast, no doubt. And the car that you see is in reality nothing but screen. And yet, the moving of the car doesn't make the screen move. The screen, while being there, sitting still, without any movement, without any change, appears as all these apparent changes. So, one of the Upanishads, therefore, Ishavasya Upanishad, presents it in a very poetic manner that it overtakes all the moving objects without itself moving at all. How can that happen? If I have to overtake a car, say, running at 80 miles an hour, then I have to drive faster than that to overtake that car. It is, if I do not move at all, if I don't budge from my place, how can I overtake that car? But this Upanishad says that is, it overtakes because when that car stops, it sees that Brahman is already there ahead of it. So it must have overtaken it. So without making any movement, it overtakes all the moving objects. So it is pervaded in and through everything. This is a transcendental and transcendentally immanent awareness that Vedanta wants to bring to us as an answer to our quest for immortality, our quest for happiness, our quest for everything that we seek actually in life, that rests in getting answer to this question, that this all-pervading reality, this ocean that vibrates in all that we see, it is vibrating, it is seen in and through all these vibrations. So it doesn't vibrate, and yet all that vibrates is that divine principle alone. So this idea is expressed here that everything that we see is divine. In every moment, in every thing that we see or know that it is divine. This is the knowledge of the divine. And this is actually acquired by great saints. That is in fact what makes them saints. It is the beautiful statement of Taittiriya Upanishad that what makes a person saint, the answer given is that when one knows that the Brahma is asti brahmeti ched veda santamenam tato viduriti, when one knows that Brahman, this all-pervading reality, is, then that person is a saint. When that awareness comes that everything is that one reality. So, it has the automatic effects in actual life. Such person therefore cannot hate anybody. Such person therefore cannot be covetous. This person therefore is fearless. All these great things that we aspire in life, they are all the automatic outcomes of this knowledge. When you get this knowledge, your love will be spontaneous. You will never hate anyone. You will not have that feeling of dislike towards anything, because all is you. You never dislike yourself. You don't feel jealous about yourself. It is only about others. When you don't see any other, then you will not have that idea at all. Friends, it sounds rather impractical on its face because we do not make a concerted attempt to it. We do not try to see the lives of great sages. But if we study that and see that that is in us also, that same principle is in me too, well, we will see that possibility of getting and imbibing that knowledge in us. We will become that. We will then not identify ourselves with a piece of flesh, that this is I, and some bones and flesh and all that is, I say this is I, that is ignorance. When the knowledge dawns, I will not make that identification. Then it shows in the next verse some apparently contradictions getting resolved into this all-pervading transcendental oneness of the divine. These contradictions, they are only on the surface, and we really are intrigued in this world by these contradictions. But all contradictions, they get resolved there. In this world, friends, there is no solution for these contradictions. And in the divine, the contradictions have no place. They do not have any meaning. So, those contradictions don't exist there. This verse tells them, 14th verse, Sarvendriya Gunabhasam Sarvendriya Vivarjitam Asattam Sarvabhrichaiva Nirgunam Gunabhobhricha. It is manifest in the functions of the various sense organs, yet bereft of all sense organs, unattached, yet sustaining everything, without attributes, and yet the protector of the qualities. Protector of the, you can say, attributes, it doesn't have any organs, but any parts. It doesn't have any such divisions, but yet whatever is being done by the organs, it is that principle which is actually making it happen. Like screen, and doesn't have anything that one see in the movie as its attribute, this green. You cannot say that it is a flower, but a flower is seen there because of this green. You cannot say that this green is a woman or a man or a car or a mountain, but all that appears there because of this green. So the functions of our sense organs or motor organs, it doesn't have any of it. So you cannot characterize it that, well, God has four hands or eight hands, that many, especially the images of the Hindu gods and goddesses, they have been shown as, say, Vishnu, for example, is shown with four hands. Mother Durga is shown as with 10 hands or sometimes with 8 hands. It is, what are these? These are the poetic descriptions of transcendence, that you don't have to just confine that Godhead into the human qualities. So to show transcendence, they attach two more hands so that you don't confuse them with a human being. So two more hands get added. But that doesn't mean that it is, it has only four hands. So it is beyond all these attributes. That is, and yet all attributes, they can function only because of it. This is a very important principle that we have seen also in the study of the ninth chapter. Here it has come as a result of our transformation of life. We start seeing this very important truth of God in and through everything, and yet not in anything. This is how these apparent contradictions get resolved in this ultimate truth, that it doesn't have any qualities. You cannot call this principle as compassionate in the regular sense of the word, like a person is compassionate. No. This, you cannot call this as a cruel being either, but all those things, they are really happening because of the presence of this divine principle. So, it is an example of movie and the screen works very well, but let us not forget it is just an analogy, an example. As one's life gets transformed, one can actually feel this idea that you see yourself as an object. Like many other things, this person, it is a very difficult achievement, friend. Since our whole life is dependent on this division, I and the world, to see this also as an object is a very difficult feat. But see the lives of like Sri Ramakrishna. That division didn't exist there, I and the world. It is, this is also like any other piece of flesh, blood, bones and all that. Just as all these pieces of flesh, bones, blood, one I call I, another I call as you. But why so? It is the same piece, same heap is other place also. So that also is equally I. So he used to call his body as this. Just as you would address some other thing, you would call this, not as I. Not that just by saying like this, it automatically our awareness will change, but his awareness was complete non-attachment with any particular thing as I. So, now it is next verse says that he is pervaded in everything, it moves and it doesn't move. And the last part of the next verse says that this is a very subtle matter, sukshmatvat-tad-avijneyam. It is difficult to know, and today our time is almost finished, so we will begin that verse, a study of that verse next Friday. Any questions for today? There is an internet question, okay.
Do we have free will? What is the difference between free will and divine will?
This question about free will does come often. This has been asked in this class also a few times. That do we have free will? Now, will itself suggests a bondage. That you will for something. That means that particular thing is tied to the will. So the will in the absolute sense has no freedom as such. An individual when thinks of free will, can I do this and can I do the, feels that there is a sense of free will there. But this sense of free will also has been put in that individual as a matter of the brain programming. Our brains are programmed in such a way that we get the feeling that we have free will. See, this is the programming, and the programmer can change that program anytime. So at the one moment I feel I have free will and I try to exercise it and I find, well, I couldn't do it. My will was not really able to achieve that. Moreover, what I will be willing, and that is not always in my control. Can I will what I should will? And that doesn't seem to be in my control, it just rises. So in that sense, I do not have any control over what I should will, what I should not will. Now divine. Let us come to the divine will. Is it a free will? In a sense, you can say that it is a free will. If the word will can be used for that, that because of the all-pervading nature of that, it becomes all-powerful as well. Or being all-powerful, now nothing can obstruct its will. So there is nothing that the divine cannot do, and so in that sense, and there is the divine will which is free. So, if that word can be used for divine, then you can say that the divine has free will. An example that Sri Ramakrishna has given a few times, not that he has entirely endorsed that, but this idea that suppose you tie a cow with a tether. When you have tied a cow like that, then as long as that tether is, the cow can move within that radius. Cannot go beyond that. So, we are also like that tied by the divine with a particular length of rope. And so within that, our so-called trivial modes, how much should be the length of that cord? We don't decide the length of the tethers. So, whatever length has been provided, we move within that and call that as free will. So, therefore our free will is really not free, but we feel it to be free. There is another beautiful idea associated with it, that what is controlled by laws, it is never free. Matter is always under control of laws. It has to do certain things according to law. There is no escape for matter from it. Matter has to obey the laws. And therefore, as matter, we are never free. As spirits, we are never bound. Spirit has no laws. So when we feel ourselves to be spirit, then we are free, and so whatever we say as will, that also to that extent is free. But as pieces of matter, we do not have any freedom, and therefore no free will either. It is a bondage really that we have to feel that we have a free will. As I said, it is programmed. That since it is programmed like that, we have no choice that I will not have any free will. And it is not possible to think that I will not have any free will. Immediately you may say that I will not have any free will, and then you go to Starbucks and think that whether I should choose this or I should choose that, as if I have got the free will. So, it is, in that sense, we don't have a free will, and yet we have the delusion of having a free will. When a person transcends that illusion, therefore doesn't talk of that. Sri Ramakrishna used to say every time, therefore, if the Divine Mother wills, whether I will or I will not, I don't know. His teacher who gave him sannyasa, Totapuri, he asked, will you take, you are deemed to be highly qualified to practice this spiritual path of knowledge, but you will have to take that vows of renunciation for that. Will you do that? And Sri Ramakrishna said, well, it is only Divine Mother knows what I will or what I will not. So I will have to ask her. So this is the awareness of such illumined people, that they don't have the idea that I have my self-will. So let us conclude with the closing prayers. गीतास्तु गीता कर्तव्या किमन्यत् शास्त्रविस्तरे या स्वयं पद्मनाभस्य मुखपद्माद्विनिश्रिता एक